The following autobiographical interview was held on April 21st, 1995 with Mr. George V. McCorkle, Harbor Master and Port Administrator, Port of Kodiak. The interview was conducted in the Harbor Master's office. The interviewer is Dennis W. Towdy, Alaska history student doing an oral history project. To start with, could you tell me a little bit about your family and a little bit about before you come to Alaska and then when you got to Alaska?
Yes, my name is George V. Berkey McCorkle, and I came from Boulder, Colorado when I was 15 years old. I finished the ninth grade, and so I was 15, and my mother remarried, and my stepdad was in the Navy, and he was stationed in Kodiak, Alaska. So when I really wasn't excited about leaving school, because that's where I was raised and went to school there most of my life, and I didn't want to leave all my friends, but in any event, we came to Alaska, and I did come up on a ship, and it was the USS O'Hara, and we left Seattle, and I believe it was about a five-day trip. We went, it was the first time I'd ever been on a big seagoing vessel, and we went to the port of Whittier first, and there was Army troops and Navy and Coast Guard, Air Force people on the ship, and they got off on the train, onto the train, and then I remember other troops got on, so it was kind of a switch there, which I'm sure that's how they rotate their personnel. And I did get to go into the big building in Whittier, big concrete building that was there. I went in there and got a Coke. I remember going up looking at this huge building. And then I found out they had swimming pools and gymnasiums and schools and everything in this whole building, this complex, because the snow there was just tremendous. Well, I came here, and it was in May, so it was springtime, and there was still a lot of snow there. And I remember that was something to see. And then we left Whittier and we came to Kodiak, and also on board were civilian personnel, civil service dependents. And then when we got off, my stepdad met my mother and I, and we drove into Kodiak. And I couldn't get over how green it was here. Didn't expect all of this beautiful green shrubbery and such, and it was all, in my mind I was thinking of like the typical Chichaco, that Alaska's covered with ice and snow and Eskimos and dog sleds and all of that. And anyway, so here's this lush green Emerald Isle for sure. And so we were driving and talking, and Dad said that the school here was had a good reputation, and good teachers, and that they had basketball. I was interested in sports, and so that made me real happy. We drove down, and we kind of went by the waterfront a little bit, and up around to the Lucian Homes, who lived on Hemlock. And so I said, "Where's the town?" And he said, "Well, we just drove through it." So I was kind of amazed at how small Kodiak was, but it didn't take me long to fall in love with Kodiak. It surely did. That summer I went downtown, and I met another young boy my age, and his name was Pat Heitman, and his father's name was August. And his dad worked for the city, but he took 2 weeks off of leave every year and went salmon fishing. And so I was very fortunate that they took me on as a greenhorn and let me go fishing with them that summer. So I had my really first experience fishing commercially. And we were in a small jitney, named the Toots, and we fished for King Crab Incorporated, which is one of the major canneries in town. And we fished over in Middle and Kelsey Bay, basically where we fished. And that was really an experience for me. I really enjoyed it. Met some other fishermen out there who I've known for years now, and who are adults, and, you know, Carl Armstrong and Bill Robertson, two names that are well remembered in Kodiak. I met those fellows, and they were in another little boat, and we fished that area. It wasn't a very good season that year, so we didn't catch an awful lot of fish, but I made about $300 or $400, and that was the most money I'd ever seen in my life all at one time. So I had money to go to school and everything, so I was really happy with that. I attended Kodiak High for 1 year, and I played varsity ball for Coach Joe Floyd. And of course, that's some 38 years ago. Joe's still here, a legend in Kodiak with athletics. They have the Christmas basketball tournament named after Joe, and the park, and so he's been a major part of my life. He also was the commanding officer of the Territorial National Guard. In fact, there was four of my teachers in school that were all officers, an English teacher, a music teacher, Mr. Floyd, and I believe, well, the other officer was an electrician on the base. And we had the largest National Guard unit in the state. We had over 100 people out of Kodiak. Well, as being I was only 16 years old, I turned 16, and I got my territorial driver's license, and I also got my permission from my mother to sign me up for the Territorial Guard. I had to change my date of birth by 1 year, but anyway, it was something to do that interested me. I've always enjoyed the military, and I had a lot of fun. In fact, so much fun that I ended up joining, enlisting in the regular army after I finished the 10th grade. And so that's that was a good year in my life, a real good year. Played ball. We got to go to Anchorage and play the varsity there, and that was a big trip off island. We got to fly, and then I went with the National Guard encampment to Camp Denali over by Anchorage, and we had our 2 weeks active duty, and that was quite an experience for me, and I really enjoyed that, being a lot of good friends. And, really, after school was out, at that time I pretty much made my mind up that my parents at that time were going to be rotated out of here, and so I decided to enlist, and so I enlisted in the Army. Then I came back to Kodiak after my tour in the Army, where I traveled over to Europe, and was there during the Berlin crisis, and good. I'm glad that thing materialized into not going into any kind of war or anything, and I was one of the first enlisted men from my unit to be released. So I came back to Kodiak in 1962, and I got a job with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in salmon research, and also in king crab research. And then I worked for them for as a construction over at Katoi Bay Hatchery on the Fog Neck Island, helped building the dam and stuff for the hatchery over there at one of the lakes. So I spent a summer out there working. And then in 1963, I joined the Kodiak Police Department, and I met my first wife, and got married in February of 63. And then in the summer of 63, I decided that I didn't want to be a policeman. I wanted to go fishing, so I went fishing with Lawrence Anderson on the Twits, which was another old jetty. So that was my second year of commercial fishing. And then I also went crab fishing on the, with my father-in-law, Henry Sanguinetti, on the Leading Lady, which was a 70-foot wooden hull crab boat. And it was a pretty good-sized boat, and a nice boat. As I believe, Johnny Gregorioff was the owner, but he was ill and passed away, and my father operated the boat for a year. And anyway, Axel Carlson was one of the crew members, and he was an old timer from, well, old timer to me then, a lifetime fisherman, and he came from Chignik, and also with his friend Walter Stepanoff from Chignik, another lifetime fisherman. And that was quite an experience for me. I learned an awful lot about fishing and the history of Alaska, just listening to the gentleman talk about events in their lives and things they'd been through. And I could never forget how Walter Stepanoff could clean a duck. When you're out fishing like that, we're fishing on the mainland, and he could clean a coot, which is a sea duck, and they're very hard to pick. You can't just pick them like you do other ducks and stuff, but he would skin these ducks out and then pot roast them. And it was one of the finest meals I think I've ever had in my life, his recipe, when he'd do that with these ducks. I also remember an incident when I got injured on the boat when a crab pot hit me across the back, and I thought I was going to have a broken back, but I was able to get back up and continue to work. And I still have an injury. My disc is slipped over and it aches all the time. We were fishing on the mainland in Dakovac Bay, and we had this one pot. It was a 6x7, a little bigger and taller than the other gear that we had. In those days, you could only have 30 crab pots, so anyway, we'd slipped it across the side of the deck, and this freak swell came along, didn't lash it down, and the darn thing fell over, and I was on the pot launcher ready to push this other pot off. The guys yelled, they saw it happen, but I didn't get a chance to move or anything, because I didn't know what was happening, and the darn thing hit me. Anyway, I managed to survive that, continued fishing and such. Also, while we were over there, some other significant things happened when the volcanoes were erupting. You could smell the sulfur and stuff in the air, and you could actually see some light during darkness from one of the mountains. And I remember they were talking to the Jaguar. Antral Saddam was a skipper of the boat, and he said it looked like maybe Katmai, one of the volcanoes near there. And then I recall when we were making our trips back to Kodiak and then back through Kuprianov Straits and across Shelikov to the mainland, that we were seeing a lot of ducks and birds dead floating in the water. And it seemed a little spooky. We were trying to wonder why all these birds were dying and such, and it may have been from the sulfur or something from the volcano that did that. Anyway, this is kind of leading up to the 1964 earthquake. These were signs that may have been showing that there was some kind of activity going on seismic wise, and being a layperson at that time, not knowing much about that, I never paid much attention to it until years later. I started thinking back that was this some kind of sign that something like this could be happening, the fact that the volcano erupting and the dead birds and so forth. We finally moved our gear from the mainland and came back, and we're fishing out here on the flats off of Kodiak. And on the morning of March 27, 1964. When I went down to the boat, we usually would leave about 6 o'clock in the morning, go out to our gear and pick the 30 pots and then come back in. But prior, on our last trip, when we tied up in town, the skipper, Henry, said that he's planned on moving all our gear. So that meant that we were going to we'd have to run all 30 pots, put them on deck, and then move to another place and set our gear. But that particular morning, for some reason, I got up early, and I came down to the boat, and the engineer, Axel, was already there. The boat was warmed up, engine running. Walter Stepanoff had slept on the boat that night, and the skipper showed up just shortly after I did, because my house was just about 3 blocks from the harbor, and I could just walk down from my house. In fact, I could hear our Lister engine. It was kind of noisy, running. And I, as long as that was running, I knew that the tanks were pumping on the crab. And, to make a long story short, we left an hour early. And so when we got out on our gear, we started picking pots, and we began to catch crab. So rather than putting the pots on deck, we throw the crab in the hold and dump the pot, bait the pots, throw them back over, which we did. And we did that in a timely manner, went real, real well. And then we headed back to town. And I remember when we were coming down the channel across from Alaska Packers, the tide was out. And Axel and Henry and Walter were talking about good clam digging. And, okay, so the tide was out, so we went into the small boat harbor and we tied up on our slip, which was all the way out on the end by the southwest breakwater. In fact, in those days, you just had a small three-pile dolphin and just a walk float, and you backed your vessel in, tied your stern off to the float, tied your bow off on the dolphin, and that was it, small dolphin. And we did that. And I remember this shotgun that I purchased when I was 15, when I came up here, I had it in my bunk for hunting ducks and stuff, and for some reason, I just grabbed it, took it home, no particular reason. It just seemed like the thing to do. And so I walked up to the house, which probably took me about 15 minutes, and got into the house, and my wife was cooking meatloaf for dinner, and my 8-month-old boy Shannon was in his crib playing, and it was cold because I had long johns on and stuff, and I was just starting to change clothes when we could, the window started shaking kind of gradually, and I thought it was the washer on a spin cycle or the dryer or something that was causing the window, and I asked my wife if she had if she was doing clothes or laundry, and she said no. I said, well, it must be the wind. And then it got more intense and more intense, and the next thing you know, this earthquake just began to build up to became where it was so violent that you couldn't stand up. You were getting tossed around against the walls and such. And I remember grabbing my son and holding him in my arms, and my mind flashed back that you're supposed to stand in the doorway when an earthquake happens. So I got my family, and as I opened the door to stand in the door, and out in this little doorway that we had with a Cali door on the outside, and there's the paper boy standing there. And I remember that nobody said anything, but we didn't have to, because you could see the look on everybody's faces, I guess, of how frightening it was, because his eyes looked like huge saucers, and I'm sure mine did too. It seemed like it was the end of the world, that it was never going to end. It just lasted and lasted. And the electric wires outside, you could hear them. They were making this weird noise. And the trees and everything was just kind of swaying back and forth. And it was still, I remember, it was still daylight. And after it kind of settled down a little bit, we turned the radio on, and the Armed Forces Radio and Television said that to evacuate the high grounds, that seismic sea waves had been seen by airplanes heading for Kodiak, and to get from low-lying areas. Well, our house was on fairly high ground. It was right under Pillar Mountain on High Street. And it was about 3 blocks from the boat harbor, but up high enough to where I felt comfortable we would be okay there. And then we had a neighbor run in the house and say that another huge wave was coming and was going to cover the whole area, and we had to get to the top of Pillar Mountain. But my son had been ill and had a bad cold and such, and I wasn't going to expose him to that element. So we decided to stay in our house because we just topped off our oil tank. We had an oil stove. And I remember looking out the window, and I could see the southeast breakwater. And the water was beginning to come over the breakwater very slowly. It was coming up. And I said, and my wife looked at it and she said, look, the water's starting to come over the breakwater. And I said, holy cow. I said, it was low tide when we came in. And so that was indeed the first activity of the tsunami. It was a slow tide that began to just kind of come up and come up. And then the water receded back out. And of course, the pilings are snapping and the boat lines are snapping. And there's a lot of noise and wind. And by this time, it's beginning to get dark. And then the water flushed right out and the boats were sitting on the bottom of the harbor. There were some activity going on where boats were trying, you could hear engines revving up and stuff, and boats trying to move around. Some did, I believe, and got out of the harbor, and some didn't, and then the channel almost went dry, and then as the water receded out, it apparently, the next wave was already coming in, and so the water going out kind of met that, and it built up this big wave, which was the second wave. From everything I've ever read about it and people that I've talked to, was, I believe the second wave was the big one that really did so much damage to and killed a lot of the folks that were out on the road. There was a lot of people out driving to Cape Chiniac because it was Good Friday. And that first wave that I mentioned to you had washed a lot of debris up on the road, and two families that were lost, there was one survivor, was this, the school teacher was the band leader, and his wife, who was a clerk at City Hall, named the Schultzes. I don't remember her husband's name, but Rosemarie was her name. Very nice couple, very nice people. And there was a Navy or Coast Guard first class petty officer and his wife and son. They had been out on a drive. And so the petty officer pulled up behind the Schultzes because there was debris in the road, and the two men got out of their cars and they were going to go over and move this log that was in front. And so they bent down and picked this log up, lifted it up, and this Coast Guard person said that the last thing he remembered was big wall of water come crashing down on top of him, and that's all he could remember. And he woke up the next night, or that night, it was still dark. The water had gone back out and everything. Of course, he was all by himself, and he didn't know where his wife or his son was and everything. He spotted a light in the ranch house out of Calson Bay, and the ranch is still there. And he followed the barbed wire fence to that house and got shelter in there during the night, and then they helped him search later. Later on, they found his wife and son, and it was she was still in the car, and he said he could never forget it. She was still sitting in the corner with her hand over her mouth, you know. Yeah, it was horrible. And they found a little boy somewhere on the beach. They found Rosemarie Schultz, and they never did find Mr. Schultz. Now, this was a story that I just told you. It was after the earthquake. I was working for a transfer company, and we went out to pack him out. And over a cup of coffee, he told me this story. And Then, getting back to that night of the earthquake, I walked along Pillar Mountain to see. I couldn't see a lot. It was pitch dark because the power was out, and there wasn't any emergency lighting at that time, but you could just hear all the crunching and the popping and the cracking and real weird noises and the wind blowing and the smell. There was, you know, this dampness, this smell that you'll never forget when the sea gets churned up like that. It stirs up everything. It's got, can't explain it exactly because it's got the smell of kelp and kind of gritty, silty, muddy stuff, and it's just hard to explain. Well, anyway, at first light, it got light. Finally, I went down and looked at the downtown area. My goodness, it just looked, you know, it's just the boats were setting up town, and the Salif was up by the schoolhouse. And different boats were scattered out throughout the downtown area, and all of the downtown, just about all the downtown area, had been battered by the fleet, by the boats going back and forth with the water and the waves smashing everything and such. So I went back to my house, and I told my wife that I planned on going down to the police department to see if there's anything I could do to help. And because I'd been a police officer prior to that for a few months. And I looked in the harbor. Of course, the leading lady was not there. She was gone. So I figured it sunk or whatever. And the boat was gone. So when I walked into the police department, and there was only 5 officers, I believe, on the police department at that time. Everybody was on duty, out doing something. And when I walked in, Chief Rhines was behind the counter, and I said, "Hi, Chief." I said, "I'm here to help. Is there anything I can do? I'm ready to go to work." And about that time, a call came in for the ambulance, so he told me, he said, "Okay, Corky, you take the ambulance. It's yours for the duration." So I drove that ambulance for the next 72 hours, and we hauled all of the casualties, the deaths, and the injured people in the ambulance back to the hospital, because they moved everybody back there and got the hospital online. And then, of course, the morgue was just across the street from the hospital, the Griffin Memorial Hospital. And end up, I believe it was 19 individuals that we lost during the earthquake. And I remember as we were bringing them in, and we were laying them in side by side, and there was not a very big room, about half the size of this office here, and we would lay the bodies down like this. And then Mac McKinley, who was used to be a policeman and a U.S. Marshal here in town, is a legend in himself. This guy was also bringing in victims and such, and so I was helping him unload, and he was helping me unload, and so forth, and these poor people. And we recognized Rosemary, and then there's somebody, the first time I'd ever face death like that, or see that many people die, and then somebody that you knew, not somebody real close, but still has a funny way of affecting me, you know, especially a drowned victim, maybe, you know, very uncomfortable thing to deal with. During that time, I remember we got an air vac with Mary Shia, one of our local elders now, and she was pregnant with one of her daughters. They have about 14 kids in the Shia family. And I met her out at the airport out here. They brought her in, I believe it was with a Navy or Coast Guard helicopter. Or something. They flew her in from Chiniac somehow. I can't remember what it was. I remember I went out with the ambulance to pick her up and got her back, and she had the baby safely. And there's other people that we called in to the hospital for treatment and that type of thing. And I remember when I was there, they were in dire need for A positive blood, which I is my type. And so I'll give you some blood. So I gave him a pint of blood or whatever, and this is after I've been up for 72 hours, not realizing how much that can affect you a little bit. Anyway, I got really sick. There was kind of the flu or something going around as well. I think I got that, plus I was fatigued and tired. And so I was out of it for a while, for about 3 or 4 days there. I just stayed home. I was real sick. And then once I recovered, I went back down and went on temporary with the Kodiak Police Department as a security officer downtown. And I walked shotgun patrol to prevent looting and larcenies and things like that during the early morning hours. My shift was from 8 at night till 8 in the morning. And
was that a problem here in Kodiak?
No, it really wasn't. They had Marines come in from the base, and they set up a perimeter around the downtown area, and the first couple of days there, I guess, I can't remember exactly how long they were there, and then they pulled them out, and then we had enough people, went ahead and hired some temporaries like myself to help the full-time officers. And so I think I worked through April, close to the end of April, and they didn't need us anymore. And then that's when I went out to the base. I worked out there for a while, and then went fishing again that summer. I went fishing on the Commander, and then
how long was Kodiak without power after the
They airport? Had power back on in relatively short order. I think it might have been the next night.
They were supplying power on their own, or was it?
Yeah, the tidal wave, the wave went around the generators down there. It's amazing how that works. It didn't wipe out the generator right on the waterfront, but it missed them, from what I understand. But they did, they were able to get not only the water, and part of the water was shut off in the downtown areas, but up where we live, we had power and water just shortly after. And the other thing is, during that time, when they evacuated the hospital, Mitch Shia and his wife, their premature baby son, Scotty, and they brought him up to our house in a little wicker basket, and we opened the oven door and put him in there and kept him alive during that time until the hospital was back open. And we had a house full of people in. I forgot to mention that. My wife and my little boy went in. We had a bedroom there, small, just a very tiny little house. But anyway, we had food on the stove all the time during this thing, and coffee and such, for people to have a place to come while I was down at the police department doing that thing. It was Kodiak was really, it showed what it was made of during that event. I mean, the people were great. I mean, you had incidents where people panicked and stuff, and which is normal during a situation like that. But town really pulled together, and with the small community we had, the small city, the amount of personnel they had, they did a fantastic job.
And do you remember about what the population?
About 2,500. Mm-hmm. So, but then, and then of course the naval base, I'm not sure what the population was at the Navy base, but it was probably about the same or not more. They had a naval air wing out there, then. It was a naval air station, so they had a squadron up from Woodby Island. They'd rotate every 6 months, as I recall, and the Coast Guard was out there also.
Was there any of the bigger Coast Guard ships up here in the area?
I believe the Storrs was here, there were some other cutters here, you know, and I didn't remember all the Sweetbriar, I think. I can't remember all the names of them then, because, you know, I wasn't that active in that kind of thing, and I just didn't remember the names of the ships. But I think the Storrs was here, because she went around up through the North Pole, her and another small cutter.
How did the fishing fleet, the ones that were underway, was able to weather the tidal waves fairly well? Or was
a lot of the boats went out of St. Paul Harbor here, past the sea. That's where they all just drove around a little bit. And now Jerry Tilley was fishing on one of the boats, and it was tied up down at King Crab Dock. And he said during the earthquake there was a local wave that we had here. It was black water kept gushing up underneath, and a small wave went right across the channel, putting out this way. There's nobody over there near St. Paul then, but that's documented in the history that they did on the story of what happened to him down there at the dock. So you know, depending if there's a fissure in the bottom of the bay, it pushed all of this pressure up, so it created a local wave too. It's my understanding that the wave hit simultaneously at the base as it did in here. It just came in all around, all at the same time. The hangars were half underwater out there.
The ship that's up high and dry here now, that's turned into a cannery?
They all Alaskan. It was a World War II Liberty ship that was brought up after the earthquake to because the entire Alaska Packers cannery, Donley and Atchison's grocery store, hardware store, the Standard Oil fuel facility was completely cleaned out. And Kodiak Western, everything that was in the channel, that lost it. There's a terrific amount of water come flushing through there. You could go down the next day, you see houses and cars and everything just floating down the channel, and the water was receding out.
So that ship wasn't set up there during the tidal?
No, that came afterwards.
How did they get it up there?
They pushed it in with tugs and barges, and had big caterpillar cats pushing around it, and then they started filling around it. In fact, that was one of the major canneries that went back online after the earthquake to get the economy going and create a lot of jobs.
So after they brought it up here, that was its purpose, basically, to put it up there and get...
Yeah, it was a processor.
How do you feel that the earthquake affected the crab in there and the fishing industry and that? Did you see a big difference?
It didn't bother the crab at all, because 1965 was the peak year of the crab fishery. They caught more crab in 65 than they ever did. It didn't affect the crab, to my knowledge.
The
64 salmon season was good. 65 was bad, but 64 was a really good year. And 66 was good, 67 wasn't good, 68 was good. Even years were good there for many years.
As far as the present day now, do you feel that Kodiak here is a lot more prepared for something like that to happen?
We are a community that's aware of seismic events, because we live on the Pacific Rim, on the Ring of Fire, and anybody that lives in the Pacific is in the tsunami zone, so we know that we could get an earthquake and a tsunami anytime. In fact, they're predicting that in the Shumagin area, the Shumagin Gap, that's off the south end of Kodiak Island, down by the Shumagins, a group of small islands down there, the Pacific Plate meets the American Plate, where those two plates are meeting each other, that this particular area hasn't had very many earthquakes in a long, long time, but when they do, they predict it's going to be a significant event, with probably eight above. So that's a major event. Now, the interesting thing about the 64 earthquake is that it was, that in 1964, they said it was an 8.5 on the Richter scale. But seismologists have upgraded that from today's technology to a 9.2, because the duration of that was 4.5 to 5 minutes, depending on who you talk to, but it's very long and significant event. The bottom of of the Gulf of Alaska from Prince William Sound, which was the beginning of the epicenter, ripped a trench across the Gulf of Alaska. And you had horizontal and vertical movement at the same time. That's why it was so violent and lasted so long. And a portion of the Pacific plate dropped some 50-some feet, several hundred miles down or something. And the deeper the water, the bigger the wave, the series of waves that you had. So it was a tremendous movement.
Do you remember, was there any significant land movement or loss over here?
Well, the island sunk downward about 6 or 7 feet, 5 or 6 feet, something like that.
The total island?
Yeah, the north end. Well, I can't speak for the south end of the island, but the Kodiak area, because we began to notice that on our tidal grids, boats that could get on during a certain height of the tide could no longer do that because the island had actually come down. But what's happened since then, since 64, it's rebounding. So Kodiak Island, where it sank kind of like this, is beginning to come back up, and rebound is called. The Roy Eklund from the surveyors here, the Eklund Surveying, when he does his survey work around here, he's documented all of that. That'd be a good story for you to do, too. It's the seismic rebounding of Kodiak Island since that event has occurred. It's come back up. That's quite interesting.
About how does the size of the harbor now compare with back in the earthquake as far as boats?
Well, in the earthquake days, we had a different float alignment here, which we didn't have near the number of boats. We didn't come close to it. I think probably during the earthquake, there was probably 250 boats that fished here. And there was probably, out of that, the local boats was probably 100 or so. And then, of course, after the earthquake, with the federal emergency funding, they rebuilt the Kodiak Harbor, Seward, and Homer. And then they got the canneries back online, and the fleet then began to grow. New crab boats were coming online, and I can remember when Oscar Dyson bought the Peggy Joe. I'm just going by memory, maybe off, but he paid $350,000 or something like that. And that was just unheard of in those days. You know, everybody thought he was out of his mind. But my goodness, you couldn't touch that boat. You couldn't buy the prop for that anymore. I'm just joking. No, I mean, the value of that boat is just awesome. But in those days, that was just, you know, unheard of to pay that kind of money for a boat. But, I mean, he was one of the pioneer fishermen here. He had a vision of, you know, what you could do. And he and other highliners, very successful fishermen, have really made it through the king crab industry during those big years, you know, when they harvested the...
You mentioned a little bit about your house there and the shaking and that. How did the houses around town that didn't really get involved with the tidal wave, how did they
fared quite well. They fared quite well. And the one positive thing about Kodiak is that we're on rock, where like in turning an arm up in Anchorage, you just turned a putty, you know, it shook and just fell apart. But here we're on a rock, and the rock moved, and we shook violently, but it didn't come apart. There was no... landslides around the city that I'm aware of. There may have been around the island somewhere, but it didn't affect anybody that I ever heard of. So I think because we were on a rocks here, that didn't hurt us near as bad. There was homes here and concrete foundations and stuff that stood up quite well. And most of the houses were on piles, and they stood up real well too. So we were, the wake did all the damage here. We were very lucky here. We didn't have fires like Seward did or that. We were lucky.
You say as far as you know, the total death toll right, for the epicenter was 19?
It was 19, as I recall. I think it was 100 something in the state. It was 119, I think, right in the ballpark. But you can imagine if we had an event like that today with the population we have and the activity that we have along the waterfront, if you didn't have a tsunami warning system like we have in place here with our sirens and our, you know, and the tsunami warning center in Palmer and our emergency preparedness planning that we have with our emergency preparedness operations training that we do here, we could be in real trouble, but I think we're on top of that. I'll give you an example of where that paid off is when we had the Exxon Valdez oil spill. When they kicked that emergency operations center into gear, we were able to put things in motion to prepare for the oil coming this way. I don't think anybody in Kodiak ever thought we were going to get affected with the oil in Prince William Sound would come to Kodiak. But we all got educated, everybody did, on how the tide and the wind and the water moves in the ocean. So it was quite an education for everybody here and a very, very learning experience.
Do you remember from the first time that you had the earthquake, how long it was before the tidal waves started coming in? And how many actual waves?
Well, it was probably within 20 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes that the tide began to rise, and significant enough to where, like I said, when I looked out the window of my house, I could see it